to episode 48 of the podcast that we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here, as always, with my savvy co-host, David Grigg. Hello, David.
Hi, Perry. Savvy. Okay.
Double V.
Yes, we have to keep coming up with these interesting adjectives, don't we? Never mind.
I saw the other day somebody on Facebook was saying, why is the word W spelled or said as W when it really should be double V?
Oh, that's true.
And I thought, well, that's true, actually, because it's not W. I don't know why they get to that one. But there we go. That's neither here nor there. What have you been up to?
Well, apart from a little bit of work being done around the house, like painting and plastering and plaster dust turning up everywhere in the entire house after that, not a great deal. Just little bits here and there. Keep myself occupied.
Just enough to keep yourself busy.
No, I keep myself very busy, really.
We've turned very much into autumn. We're both wearing jumpers today.
Yes.
And it's mid-March, and normally mid-March we would have much warmer temperatures than we've got at the moment. Still,
no complaints.
No, I'm not complaining. We had a run of very hot summers, and I'm quite glad we had a coolish one. I feel much better about it, and a lot more rain. But I'm glad we got some on the weekend, which is also good.
Yep.
So a couple of things before we get started, David. Just a few bits of information for people. Firstly, from a science fiction point of view, it's interesting to hear that NASA has named its Perseverance landing spot on Mars. This is the new rover that landed just a week or two back. The one that had to go through the 7 minutes of hell through its very complicated landing process in order to get from going like a bat out of hell to just crawling along so that it could drop safely onto the Mars surface. They have decided to name the Perseverance landing spot on Mars after Octavia E. Butler, the science fiction writer who unfortunately passed away far too young, about 2006, okay. I think. I can say that we were considering her on the list of possible guest of honour people for AussieCon 4, but unfortunately she passed away, so we weren't able to consider her, which was a bit of a shame. And she never got to the point where she was a guest of honour, although really the way that she is being lauded at the moment just about everywhere, she really should have received that honour, but just died far too young. Unfortunately.
Sounds like a case for someone to, give a posthumous Life Achievement Award.
They don't like doing that in the Nebula, for the Science Fiction Writers of America, and also the World Fantasy people don't like doing that. They like to give it to them, especially the World Fantasy like to give it to them while they're still alive. And so they miss people and they've just completely gone. And I think that's a bit silly.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, speaking of the Science Fiction Writers of America, as you know, David, they present the Nebula Awards each year, which are probably the number two awards in the science fiction field after the Hugos, although the science fiction writers, well, there should be Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, would like to think that they're probably number one, but yeah, we're fans, so we can't have anything to do with that, so we look after the Hugos a bit better. I found out something interesting just recently hidden, well, not so much hidden down there because it's up front, I just hadn't read it properly, that for a work to be eligible for the Nebula Award, it has to be published in English in the United States in the year for eligibility for the award.
Mm.
So that if a book is only published in the UK or in Australia, it is not eligible.
Mm.
Now, I wasn't aware of that or hadn't take a note of the fact that is one of their criteria. And the reason why I'm bringing all this up is that they are releasing their final shortlists for the award later today, US time. Now, there's a bit of argy-bargy with the Hugos regarding eligibility for works, especially when you look at works that are not readily available in the US. The classic one of recent times well, two really. One was Clade by James Bradley, which was published in Australia but not published in the US for a couple of years afterwards. And it wasn't readily available, but I believe that they gave it a dispensation to say that although, because it wasn't readily available in the US in its original year of publication, they allowed it to be eligible in the year when it was published in the US. Unfortunately, it didn't make the shortlist, but there we go. And the same thing with translated works. Because these are works that are in English, something like The Three-Body Problem by Xian Lao would not have been eligible in its original Chinese publication because most of the voters would not have been able to read it. And it has to be in English. So they had to be, it had to wait until it had been translated into English and published in the US in order for it to become eligible. And when it did, it actually went on to win the Hugo Award for Best Novel for that year. So that is something to be kept in mind as this year as well, because Ghost Species was published, again by James Bradley, was published in Australia last year, but not published, I'm probably going to get this wrong. I thought it was might have been published this year in the US. Maybe it was last. Anyway, if you have these situations where it's published one year in Australia and the next year in the US, it's only eligible for the award after its US publication.
Okay.
So that's something that has to be kept in mind. And that's something that we should need to keep in mind when we come up here to our next Hugo time machine, because there were a number of stories published in the UK SF magazines that do not appear on the Nebula voting ballot because they weren't eligible.
Mm.
That's just, and you know, it didn't matter whether the authors were members of the SFWA at the time. It's all about where the publication is. So that's something that's got to be kept in mind. So we'll talk.
I suppose if you think about it from the point of view that it is the Science Fiction Writers of America, you know, maybe that's the bias. Whereas the Hugo is awarded by the World Science Fiction Convention. So, you know, you'd think that the Hugo would have to be a lot more open to works in translation or works published in other countries. You would think it ought to be.
You would. Again, the Nebula Award is open to works in translation, but only after they're published in English in the US.
Yeah.
I think the Nebula's, in this more widely connected world in which we live, I think that the most of the English publications are going to be either in the US, Canada, and the UK. Oh, now that's an interesting point. If they're published in Canada, does that count?
You'd think it ought to, but
I'm not terribly sure. Well, that's another little question that I should sort of figure out. I've got a feeling it says US.
Yeah.
And in which case, you know, published over the border, bad luck, which is a bit cruel. And given that the Nebula's, you know, I think they like to tout themselves as being important in the SF field, and they are, they should have wider coverage. But that's something that I can't handle and we can't deal with because we've got no say in that at all. But there we go. We'll talk about that in a couple of episodes when we come to the 1966 Hugos, because that was the first year of the Nebulas. So we've got a bit more to cover in that particular episode when we come to it.
Yeah.
But that's about all I've got to say leading up to today's episode. Do you got anything you'd like to add just at this point?
Not in general terms, no, I don't think so, no.
All right, well, I think we just might march along to our wonderful program for today, which we're going to be talking about what we've been reading lately.
Okay, that sounds unusual.
Yeah, it is unusual. Well, we've got a lot of other things on our plates just at the moment that we are dealing with that sort of adjacent to this particular podcast, but not directly impacting it, but slowing down our reading in terms of getting to a specific topic or a specific theme within science fiction.
Yeah.
So we're just staying with what we've been reading lately, and we do have a tendency to read some diverse books. And
indeed.
You've got an interesting one first up, David.
Yes, I thought I would talk about yet another book by the Japanese author Haruki Murakami. And as always, apologies of any of the pronunciation that follows because I don't speak Japanese. So I'll do my best. But yeah, this is a book called Norwegian Wood. And you think that's an interesting title. So it turns out that it's a semi-autobiographical novel by Murakami. It's based apparently very loosely on his years at college in Tokyo in the late 1960s and early 1970s. And it's written in the first person from the point of view of a young gentleman called Toru Watanabe. Now, he was just 20 years old in 1969, which is the period that most of the book covers. But the book actually opens a couple of decades later when he's on board a plane which is landing in Hamburg in Germany. And it lands, and as the plane taxis towards the terminal, there's background music playing, as that often is often the case on an aircraft. And the background music is the Beatles' Norwegian Wood. And Watanabe listens to this and he reacts really emotionally and has to cover his face with his hands. He's obviously in distress, and the stewardess comes and tries to see if he needs any help. But it's because he's heard this song and it's plunged him back into painful memories of his student years, and in particular his relationship with a girl, Naoko. Now, Naoko was the girlfriend of Watanabe's best friend, Kizuki. But Kizuki committed suicide. He killed himself, and this seems to have really badly affected Naoko's mental stability, as you'd imagine it would. So after Kizuku's death, she and Watanabe are drawn closely together, and they become very close friends, and they go on long walks together, and they talk into the late hours. But at that stage, it's a pretty much a platonic relationship. But she starts to suffer from mental illness and to struggle with life. And so his relationship, as I say, is really his relationship with her is in a sort of state of suspense throughout his college years. And well, I mean, he's got mates at college who take him off every weekend, and they sort of pick up girls and have casual sexual relationships with them, without any sort of commitment. His relationship with Naoko is entirely platonic until one particular night when they do, in fact, go to bed together. After which, though, she sort of really pushes him away and almost goes into hiding from him. Nevertheless, he feels an obligation to her, and he can't let her go. He can't re let his relationship with her go. And so they keep corresponding. She does get back in touch with him, and they keep corresponding. She eventually moves into a managed community for people who do have mental problems, which is in a rural setting in Japan. And Watanabe visits her there several times. And she has a friend, though, there called Reiko, who's another voluntary patient at the center and who's become Naoko's friend and protector. She's a musician, and often she plays her guitar to Naoko and Watanabe when he visits. And she plays both classical music, Bach and so on, as well as popular hits such as the music of the Beatles, including, of course, Naoko's favorite, Norwegian Wood. So this whole relationship sort of puts Watanabe in a sort of state of suspense, and he has trouble maintaining any long-term relationship with anyone else. He does develop a fledgling relationship with another young woman, a fellow student called Midori, but he really feels unable to commit himself fully to her while Naoko is still foremost in his mind. And Midori, of course, isn't happy with this, and their relationship sort of falls over. But eventually, Naoko herself tragically commits suicide while she's in this rural retreat. She hangs herself, and Watanabe goes through this period of really deep despair before he finally regains his stability and starts to sort of go on with the rest of his life. I thought this was a very good book. It's got very interesting characters, very interesting but complex relationships and it's got a fair bit to say about mental illness, attitudes to sex, and Japanese society as a whole. I liked it quite a lot, so I'm going to keep on working through Murakami's novels and see if I get through all that he's written, but it'll take me a while.
This is the one that I think a lot of people will have heard of. It's one of the ones that he's majorly known for, I would think. Good to see that there's that cross-cultural spread or intermixing between the Japanese on one side and the UK on the other with the Beatles. They were a major impact on most of us back in the 60s and early 70s.
Yeah.
And I think we did we just pass the a major milestone of the 40th anniversary of John Lennon's death last December, and that was a bit of a shock. A lot of people of our older generation would be able to say it was the big thing, especially in the US, that where were you when you heard that Kennedy died? Well, you're a bit older than me, David, but I was what, 8, 7 when Kennedy died? Oh, I don't have a foggiest idea where I was. I think I remember my father telling me that he'd read the paper and the president was dead, but I have absolutely no idea. But I do remember the day that Lennon died. That was very peculiar. I was working in the public service. Of course, this is well before mobile phones and the internet, but the news passed around so fast in the building in which I was working in the public service that everybody knew about it within an hour. It was quite astounding. It was a major, major impact on everybody. So good to see those cross-cultural impacts coming together and being discussed and having a different view of something that we grew up with. And having somebody else coming in from a different point of view, it's great stuff.
Sure.
There's a few different points of view in some of the stuff that I'm going to be dealing with today as well, which is good. But I'm going to take a bit of a sidestep here, David. I'm not going to talk about a book first up.
Oh, okay.
I'm not even going to talk about a piece of fiction.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to talk about a fanzine.
All right.
Now, we've spoken about fanzines before. Well, these are the fan magazines. The ones that you and I grew up with, because you started back in the mumble, mumble.
I started 70s.
70, well, yours early 70s, I was later 70s. And ours were all printed. So we had to basically get out the Roneos, or if you're lucky enough to find a photocopier or an offset printer that somebody could do it for you.
Or a hectograph, by God. I used a hectograph once. Once was enough.
Oh, no, don't like those things. Anyway, so Roneos, duplicators, all that sort of stuff. So we started off with those. These days, of course, a lot of the fanzines that are out there are, well, PDFs. I mean, you and I both do small fanzines in which we make them into a PDF document and make them available under various forms, sometimes general distribution and sometimes through NAPA, an Amateur Publishing Association, of which we're both a member, and ZAPA. But a lot of them are done as blogs. Or on a website. Now, the one that I want to talk about today is a fanzine called Galactic Journey. Now, this has been designated a fanzine, as it is, and it's been shortlisted for the Best Fanzine Award for the Hugos between 2018 and 2020. And to be perfectly frank, I could see that there's a fairly good chance that it will be on the ballot again this year. I've been reading it now for the last couple of months, and I'm really taken with it. Now, this fanzine started in 2013, and it's a CIRCON, SF and Fantasy Literature Review site. Now, I should explain what a CIRCON is. That's serious constructive criticism. It basically looks at things in a reviewing sort of way. So, in a sense, we're a CIRCON podcast, aren't we, David?
Sure.
We have a little bit of we have fun around the edges, but basically, we try to do serious constructive reviewing of things. We're not here to slam anything as best we can. We're here to sort of review parts of the different genres that we deal with in crime, SF, fantasy, film, television, and all that thing. Try to actually make connections around where we can and to give the listener some idea about what might be worth their spending their time on. Same thing with this one. Now, this particular fanzine covers genre magazines. So a genre magazine, or genre fiction overall, basically, let us say that. So it looks at SF magazines, anthologies, books, but it also covers life events, music, politics, and film. And it's edited by Gideon Marcus and a few others. There's about four or five of them. And entries are posted every couple of days. So there's always plenty to read. It always sort of turns up and it's always there. Now, the interesting thing that makes this one a little bit different is that its main conceit is that its contributors blog on a day-by-day basis as if they were living 55 years ago.
Okay.
So this is a bit weird, but bear with me here. Bear with me. It's really quite interesting. So today's entry there's one that popped up today. So today's entry deals with the stories in the May 1966 Worlds of Tomorrow professional science fiction magazine.
Okay.
Now that magazine had stories by people like A. Van Vogt, Perry Vreeland. I'd never heard of Perry Vreeland. I don't know who they are. And in fact, this is their only story. Okay. I looked up because I thought, you know, Perry, it's got Perry in the front, in the person's first name. I'm going to basically go and have a look and see if they only published this one story. Now, that would lead you to believe it's probably a pseudonym, but who knows? Anyway, Keith Roberts, who seemed to be turning up everywhere in the 60s, Joseph P. Martino, Robert M. W. Dixon, C.C. McCapp, who you've probably heard of, and Philip K. Dick. So there's an original Phil K. Dick story in this.
Okay.
Now, each entry that they do is illustrated by scans of the cover of the issue, and also scans of the illustrations for the stories inside. And the contributor to the blog works through every story, giving a slight capsule review and giving them a star rating, and then basically making a bit of a comment about the overall way the magazine went. Some of them will basically start off with reviews of the films that were released that particular week.
Okay, well.
Or music, singles that were released, or albums that were released that week, or books. Sometimes they will actually do a book review, and sometimes they just throw a book review in for one day. But it had to have come out in that particular time period, and in this case, they're dealing with around about April or May 1966. So it's very, and you have all these old photos as well, and suddenly you see something like, I didn't realise that single was released that time. Well, that's interesting. Now, I'm interested in that particular time because I'm using this fanzine to go back and have a look at the short science fiction that was published in 1965. This is leading into the 1966 Hugo Awards episode that we've got coming up in a month or so. So I'm utilising it to give me a first cut, if you like. I don't want to have to go back and read every single story that was published in that year because there's like hundreds of the things. I probably still should count them up at some point and sort of tally them up and see how many there were, but there were a lot. And there was a lot of short fiction being published around that time. So these people are doing my first cut readers, if you like. So they're basically going in and giving it a one star or a two star or, you know, something along those lines. They're covering mostly American science fiction magazines, but that was the bulk of what was around at that time. Interesting that later on in the 70s, there was a lot of original science fiction published in original science fiction anthologies. But in this particular year, I've done a bit of a look through and I can only find the new writings in SF anthologies that came out from, this is for the 1965 year, not 66, but anyway, so I've moved on a bit. Sorry about that.
Yes,
but the four that were published in 65, and I think there are probably only two or three original SF anthologies published in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
So the bulk of the short fiction that was being published then was being published in the professional science fiction magazines, and you needed to be across those in order to have an idea of what was happening in the field. And these people are providing it. It's just a very interesting concept, and it just works. And I it's very interesting to read. I get one of these messages blobbing into my inbox saying there's a new blog post every couple of days. I go and have a bit of a skim and have a bit of a look, and I go, oh, okay, they read it. Interesting stuff. So I'm enjoying it.
It's interesting that they're doing it that way, you know, actually as a website and blog post rather than as an email newsletter, because email newsletters seem to be the coming thing, and you could issue one of those, you know. So rather than get the email to tell you to go to the website, you actually just read the email, which is nicely formatted and pictures and so on. This I follow a number of email newsletters like that, so but not along the same lines as you're talking about, but just generally talking about other stuff, but it's an interesting way of doing things.
So you basically subscribe to the newsletter and then you just get it popping in your mailbox?
Yeah, every couple of weeks.
Once a week or a couple of weeks?
Yeah, okay. Right.
Yeah. Well, these things are popping up every 2 or 3 days. And I know sooner or later I'm going to get to the point where I'm going to feel as though I'm getting a bit sick of it. But at the moment, it's very, very, very useful for me. And I'm very grateful that they're out there and doing this work.
Sure. All right. My next one is a book. And it's called The Midnight Library by Matt Haig. I found this a very annoying book. It's one of those books that comes out and it's got splashed all over the cover how wonderful it is and all these people saying how terrific and inspiring and wonderful it is. And I didn't think so. So let's look at the concept and why I find it annoying. So the protagonist of the book is a young woman called Nora Seed. Whose life seems to be spiraling downwards. We find out about several disappointments and bad decisions that she's made during her life. She walked out on her boyfriend days before their wedding. She gave up on a promising music career. She regrets not pursuing an interest in geology when she was at university. And so she's really sort of doing a pretty ordinary sort of job. And eventually she gets told that she's been fired. She's lost that job. And so she goes home that night and in despair. Oh, that's right. And the next thing happens, I think, is her cat gets run down. And so in despair, she takes an overdose that night. And she wakes up in the Midnight Library. This is a strange, mysterious building in the middle of a forest. Of course, it's nighttime because it's midnight. And there's a clock which the hands are pointing to midnight. And she goes inside the Midnight Library and it's staffed by her old school librarian who she was very, very friendly with at school. And the building, we discover, is full of books. Each of them represents, she's told this by the librarian, the building is full of books, each representing one possible life Nora could have lived, depending on the decisions that she'd made during her life. So the librarian starts off by handing her this heavy volume called The Book of Regrets. And she tells Nora that it's full of all the things that she regrets in her life. And she needs to choose a book in which one of these regrets is reversed. So she chooses a book from this endless series of shelves. And the librarian helps her choose a particular book, which is the one about her regret about her wedding. And she's taken to a life in which she did, in fact, marry the boyfriend. Now, for some reason, she gets told this and suddenly, there's a misty thing and suddenly she wakes up in the body of herself in this new life. But for some reason, when she drops into the life, Nora has no memory of what's been happening to this alternate self, which makes things pretty awkward, to say the least, because she has to cover up the fact that she doesn't remember what the heck's been happening, yesterday or a couple of hours before. So she discovers after a while being in this life that the married life really didn't work out too well and she was probably right not to marry the boyfriend. So that's a big disappointment. And when she realizes that, she returns to the Midnight Library again. And so it goes on. Nora keeps choosing different lives and seeing how they turned out. And every time she has to cope with not having any recent memory of what her other self has been doing. And these struggles with the fact that she doesn't have the memory is actually probably the most interesting part of the book. But they don't actually make a lot of sense, in the context of the story, I don't think. So, why should she not have any previous memories? Anyway, so the story goes on. Nora continues this way for quite a while, experiencing different branches of her life. One after another, she experiences the one where she actually did follow a music career and becomes a famous celebrity. But there's problems with that life too. And so it goes on and on. We have several of these lives. And we eventually get to the point where the author starts saying, sort of hand-wavy way, rather than going into any detail, oh, Nora's experienced hundreds and hundreds of different lives, but she's never able to find one that works out ideally for her. And so right toward the end, when she's in a life where she's in a domestic situation and she has had a young child, and she'd like to stay in that life, but she's told, for some reason, which I couldn't quite work out, that she can't stay in that life. And she returns again to the Midnight Library. Things in the Midnight Library start to come apart because her body in the original life is starting to die. So anyway, you go on and you can sort of see where it's going. I could see where it was going about halfway through. Yes, in the end, Nora discovers that the best life she could have lived was the one that she started out in. She returns to that life, doesn't die, and lives happily ever after.
Oh, dear.
This is why I find it so annoying. And they say, well, you can see that coming. I found it really annoying. It's full of this kind of fake sentiment. It's kind of like basically identical to the plot or the concept of the Frank Capra movie, It's a Wonderful Life, but without the charm of Jimmy Stewart's acting. So I gave it 3 stars on Goodreads, and that was a bit of a stretch, I have to say. So, yeah, I would not recommend it, this one. Not recommended.
Okay. All right, that's a pity, because I'd read a few things about it, and it seemed like it was going to be okay, isn't it?
Well, maybe it's just me, lots of people. Obviously, because of the blurbs, lots of people think same as those books by Chris Hammer. All these people saying this is the best thing ever written.
And you'll sit there going, what the hell are they talking about?
I don't know what I'm missing, but yeah, I just thought this was, it's just a hokey concept and overly sentimental. And, it's making this sort of too much of a platitude and a sort of point. You know, the best life is the one you're actually in. Anyway, there we go.
Okay. Oh, well, good luck. It's just some things are all right, but, you just, unfortunately, some of them just don't work. My next book that I'm going to be talking about is The Raven Tower by Anne Leckie. Now, you, David, will remember Anne Leckie, who debuted in the SF genre in 2013 and made a really big splash with her first novel, Ancillary Justice, which went on and swept the field, won the Hugo and the Nebula, the Locus SF Award, Arthur C. Clarke Award. It didn't win the Locus SF because it was a first novel, and therefore it wasn't eligible for the Locus SF. It was only eligible for the First Novel Award, which didn't win. But it did win, as I said, the Hugo, the Nebula, the Arthur C. Clarke, and the British Science Fiction Association Award for Best Novel for that year. Big splash. Followed by 2 other science fiction novels, Ancillary Sword in 2014 and Ancillary Mercy in 2015, which went together to make up a trilogy. Most people's view was the first one was pretty damn good. Second one, not so good, but still okay. Third one, bit better, but not as good as the first. Classic first trilogy by a new SF author. The first one's a big splash because they've been working on it for a long period of time. Second one, it's a bit like second albums by rock bands. Never always as good as the first one, because they've been working, honing it for so long, the first one, playing it live all over the place. They've got it down pat. It's fantastic. Not spending quite as long on the second one. But anyway, so she did pretty well. Then she published another science fiction novel called Provenance, which was in the same Imperial Radich universe as the Ancillary series, but not a direct sequel. It was just in there. And I thought that was, it was okay. It was, it showed that she had some good writing chops and knew what she was doing. That was 2017. And then there was been a bit of a gap until, well, it was two years. I suppose it's not too bad, 2 years. Before she came out with this one, which is The Raven Tower, which is her first fantasy novel. Now, the interesting thing about this particular book is that it was eligible for the 2020 Hugo Award, having been published in 2019. And it received a very high number of nominations, enough for it to appear on the ballot. Now, as you know, David, because you've actually done this work way back in 1975, that when a novel appears to receive enough votes to appear on the ballot, the administrators for the Hugo Award contact the author or authors of the particular work and ask them whether they want it to appear, because it's up to everybody's right to say, no, I don't want to do that. And she declined the nomination for this. She did explain it, but I thought it was a bit, doesn't matter. Her choice, she's allowed to do it. There's no recourse, that was fine. So she didn't appear on the ballot, but she did appear on the ballot for the World Fantasy Award. Maybe that's what she was thinking of, that she was probably going to want to end up there. Unfortunately, she didn't win that, but I'll be talking about the book that did win for that year in a minute, and I'll explain why I think the World Fantasy Award people made the wrong choice. Anyway, so this is Leckie's first foray into fantasy. It's another one of those big fantasy volumes. It's 400 pages, but this one's actually not bad. It flows quite well, although it takes a while for you to figure out what the heck's going on. I don't know about you, David, but have you come across many books that are written almost in the second person? It's somebody sort of saying, yeah, you know, the narrator is an I, but they're saying, I saw you and you were doing this. And it's all about you doing this and you doing that.
Yeah, it's a strange sort of form.
It's a very, very strange point of view, and it takes a little while to get used to. It's fairly well done, but once it gets flowing, it's sort of, yeah, it follows. And you keep thinking, I wonder who this is. But you figure out relatively quickly who it is writing, who it is the narrator of this. And the narrator of the book is an actual god, well, revered as a god. It's actually a big lump of metal. It's a big lump of sky metal that's landed on this particular planet. And has a number of powers, and gets more powers from the number of people that worship it. So the more offerings that are made to it, sacrifices that are made to it, the more powerful it becomes. And it is talking about a situation for this particular kingdom. So what it comes to is that in this particular kingdom, or the city of Iridan, or the kingdom of Iridan, all the transactions with gods are a very complicated business. The city that of Vastai, again, we're getting all these names that are really hard to pronounce. The city of Vastai is ruled over and protected by a raven god who sits in a tower. Now, the only person that the raven god will talk to or interact with is referred to as the raven's lease. Now, this is an hereditary position. And the situation is that ravens, of course, don't live as long as humans, but they do live quite a long time. But when the raven god dies, it is an incumbent on the raven's lease to immediately go to the raven tower, enter a secret kingdom and commit suicide, thereby supplying as the sacrifice for the soul energy, or the life energy, if you like, to the new raven that is going to be born to become the raven god. And the raven's lease's heir, who they have to name, it's normally a patriarchal, they have to name, is the one that comes in and takes over the role of the raven's lease. Now, the situation occurs here at the beginning of this particular book, where the raven has died and the heir is on its way back to the city, to take over the role of the raven's lease. Now, theoretically, what happens is that when there's a particular bench, like a throne, but they don't call it that, they just call it a bench, that when only a raven's lease can sit on that bench without dying. When the heir turns up, he finds out that his uncle, his father's younger brother, has stepped in and is now sitting on the bench, but has not died. And the heir can't work out what is going on here. And he can't work out why the raven has allowed the uncle to take over. Well, of course, the raven hasn't been born yet, so there's this sort of little bit of a gap. So the uncle's acting as a usurper. And as you go along a little bit and you feel and realise that the story that has been told by the god is talking about you, which is the heir's companion who's coming along and dealing with everything that's going on. And a little bit more happens, and a little bit more happens. And then you realise that this is a retelling of the story of Hamlet.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It sounded quite familiar.
It takes a little while to get there, but you say, oh, yeah, okay. Sort of slowly starts picking up. It's done pretty well. There's a lot of fairly interesting things that go on in this book. Now there's an external threat from other kingdoms around, as there always is in fantasy novels, of course.
No way.
Is this particular set of god for the that's also protecting the city, the forest god, is it doing what it needs to do? Is everything falling apart because the uncle's moved in, and what's the heir going to do? Is the heir going to kill the... it is complicated, but I thought it was pretty good. It's a fairly intricate and detailed fantasy. I can see why it got a lot of votes in the Hugo Award. I was a bit annoyed with it for a fair way through, because it takes a little while to get used to that second person narration technique, but it seems to work and it seems to come together. Basically, yeah, it all just sort of seems to sort of drop into place in the end. I gave it a 3.8 out of 5. I think that Leckie can write in both genres fairly well, if this is anything to go by. And so, I think she's certainly somebody to look out for.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. All right. Well, my last book is, I suppose, a bit unusual, only in the sense that it wasn't a book from one of the major publishers. So, in fact, I spotted the book being promoted on Twitter one day. And it occurred to me that on this podcast, we're generally only ever talking about books from the major publishers. And goodness knows there are enough of those sort of books. But there are also hundreds of books being published annually by small independent publishers. So I decided that I should probably try to read at least two or three such books from indie publishers each year, just to see what's out there outside the mainstream. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I saw this book being promoted, and I got in contact with the publisher, Hoebeck Books. Hoebeck apparently specialises in crime, thrillers and suspense. Small publisher in Britain, independent publisher in Britain. And this particular book that I want to talk about is called Daria's Daughter. And this has only come out recently, and it came out in February this year. So when I got in contact with them about it, they very kindly sent me a copy to review, which I'm now doing. Now, I suppose that, Daria's Daughter would fall into the category of light suspense, something like that. So Linda Huber, the author, turns out, this is spelled H-U-B-E-R, by the way, Linda Huber, the author, turns out to have published some 50 short stories previously, and she's also written 9 novels previously, so she's no novice to writing. She was born in Scotland, but she moved to Switzerland in her early 20s and has lived there ever since, but she kept on writing. So onto this book called Daria's Daughter. It's really a novel about mothers and their protectiveness for their children and how they might cope with the devastating grief of the loss of a child. So it's set in Glasgow. The story is fairly simple. Daria and her 4-year-old daughter, Evie, are on the way to the airport, where they're going to fly to Spain to see Daria's parents, who live there now. They'll rejoin her husband, Ned, there, as he's been travelling on business, and then he'll join them in Spain. But she's running a bit late, and the taxi arrives a bit late, and the roads are wet, and the taxi's racing to catch up, miss time, knowing that she's desperate to catch the plane. Speeding off to the airport, the taxi has an accident. It's involved in a catastrophic accident with a petrol tanker. Daria is thrown out and she quickly lapses into unconsciousness, but not before she can hear her daughter Evie wailing somewhere in distress. And then Daria smells the smell of petrol, and she knows no more after that. She wakes up a little bit later in hospital, and her husband eventually breaks it to her that Evie is dead. Daria is obviously consumed by grief, and it takes her quite a while after that to ask to see Evie's body. But she's told that her husband Ned has already arranged for the child to have been cremated. Ned's a bit of a bastard, actually, and it's not long before he starts blaming Daria for Evie's loss, saying that she should have arranged for the taxi to have a proper child seat, and so on. And we start to actually have suspicions about Ned at that point. Anyway, we get switched to the point of view of a character called Margie, who's an old woman, an old Irish woman who's living in Glasgow, but she's struggling to survive on the pension, and she's suffering from a degree of dementia, quite a bit of dementia. She is actually a witness to the accident, and she's there in time to pull Evie out of the taxi and to take her away to a safe distance before the spilled petrol ignites and there's a big fireball. you think, oh, it's good, the child's been saved. But Margie's, because she has dementia, is very confused and very quickly begins to believe that Evie is in fact her own daughter, Bridie, and takes her home to her decrepit, very badly maintained house. Evie doesn't sort of in shock from the accident and doesn't quite understand what's going on, and she wants her mother. But Margie keeps telling her that Mammy's here and is going to look after her. After a while, Evie starts to get used to being called Bridie by this woman and almost starts to think of it as her own name. So she's there for quite a bit of time, a few weeks. So we're all also introduced to a third mother, Leanne, who is a divorced mother who also has a young female child who's called Frith. And she's struggling to manage in a rented flat. She's juggling a desperately needed job with the needs of childcare. And she turns out to have been an old school friend of Daria, who she hasn't seen in many years. But eventually she meets up with her and becomes involved in Daria's story. In fact, a few weeks after Daria's accident, Leanne moves into a new rental house, which turns out to be next door to where Margie is living with the child she calls Bridie. Bit too much of a coincidence, I thought there, but not too bad, not too unbelievable. Look, you know, I quite enjoy this. It might not be to everybody's taste, but the author keeps up the suspense pretty well, and she certainly writes well and outlines interesting characters. So it raises these questions of, you know, will Daria be able to cope with her grief? Will she discover that her daughter is, or when will she discover that her daughter is still alive? Will Evie be okay when she's being looked after by this old woman whose mind is rapidly losing any contact with reality? The only major criticism I would have is that the character of Ned, Daria's husband, is set up early on to be really a bastard, as I say, a bit of an unfeeling character, really doesn't understand what Daria is going through and blames her very unfairly for the accident. But as it turns out, he never really gets a comeuppance for that. And I also, as I started off, feeling there was some sort of complex subplot going on that he was concealing things. It turns out actually he was concealing the fact that when he told Daria that Evie had been cremated, he was kind of smoothing over the fact that she'd been cremated in this fireball of the petrol tanker going up after the accident. But yeah, it seemed a bit cruel to deal with it that way, to me anyway. But as I say, he never seems to suffer any consequences of that. So that was just a bit of a downer for me. But otherwise, I actually thought it was well worth the read. So thank you to Hubick Books for letting me have a copy.
That's good to hear. I'm back onto fantasy again. As I sort of alluded to, I'm now dealing with going to be looking at the 2020 World Fantasy Award winner, the title of which is Queen of the Conquered by Kacen Callender, K-A-C-E-N Callender. Now, I believe this author has written a number of novels for young adults, but this is her first adult novel, and it's another long one, over 400 pages. Now, just to give you a bit of an idea of what books this particular novel was up against for the World Fantasy Award, it was up against Gideon the Ninth, which I discussed last year. That was lesbian neuromancer space pirates. Weird book, but took a while to get going. The Memory Police by Yoko Ogawa, which is a translated Japanese novel, which I have not read, but which I've heard good things about. And it's actually the only one on the shortlist here that I haven't read, and I will be attempting to do so sometime when I can squeeze it in around the edges of the other things. The Raven Tower by Anne Leckie, which I just spoke about. And the other one is The 10,000 Doors of January by Alex E. Harrow, which I really enjoyed. Portal Fantasy, which didn't win the... I think it won the Locus First Novel Award, but that was the one that it won last year. So anyway, so I had high hopes for this particular book. Weren't quite realised, unfortunately.
No.
Okay, so to give you the basic outline of this thing, because I won't go into it in great detail... Sigourney Rose is the daughter of a family of noble lineage on the islands of Hans Loic. She is of African descent. What we're talking about here is a world where all of these islands, it's based sort of on the slave trade in the Caribbean at some point. The hierarchical islander rulers are all from some semi-European sounding country. They're all white. All of the slaves are various colours of brown and black, of course. Now, Sigourney Rose is of African descent, and now she's the only survivor of her family's massacre at the hands of the islanders, colonisers, the whites. For some reason or other, the reason escapes me, but basically her mother was being an inconvenience to a lot of people, and they decided that the best thing for them to do was to kill them all. Sigourney was saved by one of the slaves that worked for her mother and who then sacrificed herself. Sigourney was picked up by somebody who her mother had, a slave that her mother had previously freed, and was raised by her, taken off somewhere around to the north. And then basically Sigourney comes back to the islands, probably for revenge. And well, the other thing that I need to tell you about in this particular book to make this a fantasy, other than the fact that it's just basically set on this sort of world, is that a number of the people in this community, when they hit puberty, pick up a sort of magical power. Some people are
Okay.
able to ask questions of people, which and that forces them to give a truthful answer. Some people are able to control other people by taking control of their bodies and forcing them to do things like either kill other people around them or in fact kill themselves. Or they can basically just stand there and just constrict their air passages and stop their heart and they drop dead. That is actually the power that Sigourney Rose has, and she decides that this is a very powerful and useful power to have, and that she basically is going to wangle her way back into the hierarchy of the island, find a particular family who has a young son or a son who doesn't have very many prospects, and convince the son's mother that she is the only one the son can marry in order to be able to move up. Because what's happened is that the king of the island has to name the his successor, and he's called all the hierarchy families together. Now, Sigourney Rose somehow knows that this is going to be happening at some time soon, and so she wangles her way in, marries this son of this lesser house, and gets invited into the sort of conclave, if you like, where the king is going to announce his heir. Now, Sigourney Rose's whole idea is that she, for some reason, rather feels that she is going to be able to get to the point where her husband is going to get named as the heir to the throne, and that she's going to be able to bop him off and take over. Well, I really wasn't very convinced by this, to be perfectly frank. But anyway, so we carry along. Rose is really naive in terms of how she goes about wanting to do this. She makes a really lot of bad decisions about what she's going to do. All of the rest of the families are much more conniving and better at the politics of maneuvering their people to being in the right place, getting rid of some others. People start to die. Everybody says, "Oh, it's Sigourney Rose that's doing this because she's got this power to be able to do it," which, of course, you know, it's just a load of codswallop. But it's all been set up, and she gets manipulated around all over the place. It's interesting. It's a different way of looking at politics and hierarchy, but the first couple of hundred pages are so repetitive. I reckon if we get the story of her mother's slaughter once, we get it about four times, continually using phrases that jar a little bit, that are used like 8 or 10 times. I don't know why, I don't know what. Some reason or other, she picks up on this idea of a phrase, and maybe that's the one that they use, but it doesn't make any sense to me. When they talk about somebody killing somebody by cutting their neck, I refer to somebody as cutting the throat, because if you cut the throat, you cut the front of it. You cut the neck, you cut it on the side. You don't necessarily kill them if you do that. Cut their throat, well, then yes, you know exactly what you're talking about. I don't know, it jarred with me a bit. This particular book is, it would have been better if the editor had used a sharper pencil, I think, and used it more often. Take about 80 to 100 pages off it, would have been a much, much better book. It just goes on far too long and it drags a lot. And then it kicks off at the end and sort of really gets going and you go, oh, that's what's happening. So you come out of it a little bit better at the end because you think, oh, right, the manipulation's happening on a number of levels here that you weren't necessarily aware of, but you look back and go, oh, yeah, okay, I can see what was happening now. But it just took forever to get there. It just took forever to get there. And I have absolutely no idea how she actually makes it through to the end of the novel. I would have thought that there was about 10 or 12 times that people say, I'm going to kill you because that's the only response I've got, and they don't do it.
Yeah.
And I thought, if they just did it, what would happen? Because there's one particular guy that his power is that he can stop other people using their powers on him. So, and he's much bigger than her, and he could just basically go and kill her, but he doesn't. I don't get it. Anyway, so, look, interesting. It was not the best book by a long chalk in the on the ballot, as far as I was concerned. I would have thought either or any of Gideon the Ninth, Raven Tower, or the 10,000 Doors of January was a better book than this one. But, hey,
we're not the judges.
We're not the judges, so we don't know. So it obviously struck a chord with a number of people. I just thought it needed more work. So that's it. So that's me done.
Indeed. All right. I believe that you're going to have a bit of a chat with a friend of the podcast about her favourite books from last year.
Yeah, I'm talking to Lucy Sussex, or did recently. So this is a pre-recorded interview with Lucy about her reading in 2020 and asking her about what she enjoyed from 2020. We did this last year with her and it was pretty good. You actually found a number of books and so did I. And she actually mentioned some of them that were there. We mentioned last year and I have to go back out and read those because I'd forgotten about them. So I started off by asking her how her reading went in 2020, because as you know, a lot of us had a little bit of trouble. And I just wanted to know how she got on. So Lucy, 2020 wasn't a great year for a lot of people. A lot of people found that they were struggling to actually concentrate on even picking up a book at all. How did you go?
I was writing a book, so that sort of kept me busy. And because it was Mary Fortune, because we kept on discovering new work by her during that time, which also meant that I'd suddenly have to nick off and acquaint myself with subjects like the mapping of Ireland in the 1820s, which turned out to be fascinating. But there was a lot of work which was 19th century and not really, although some of it was intensely interesting, it wasn't very interesting to anybody else. Also work-related was the bit of reviewing work I did, which was somewhat interrupted by lockdown, in that things like a really interesting book by Francesca Wade called Square Hauntings, which is about a square in London which managed to host everybody from Virginia Woolf to Hope Merleys. That was by Francesca Wade, and I requested something like three different media outlets. I wanted to do it, and of course, with lockdown, we couldn't lay hands on it. And I suspect I would have loved it. I'm just waiting for the paperback now, which is next month. But the thing about reviewing is it forces you to read something more closely. And if you are, and partly because you're looking for errors, but when somebody's on top of your game, being forced to do that sort of thing, you really, really appreciate it. And also when you've got a longer length, because I used to have the interesting job of having to read about six or seven books and sum them up in about 100 words, which meant to some odd conversations, as in, oh yeah, I say to famous author, oh yes, I reviewed you in 110 words. And one of them said, well done. And the other one was completely lost for words, the latter being Ted Chiang. So, if you've got more space, it actually means you can explore a book more, and that's for your benefit and the authors and you hope the readers. So one of these I had this year was Truganini, which I asked for. Cassandra Pybus, which has a fabulous cover. Now, Cassandra Pybus is a fairly well-known historian, and she comes from ancient in the sense of European settlement Tasmanian family. And she knows perfectly well what her family were like because her first book on the subject was called Community of Thieves. And yes, she benefits from the dispossession of the Tasmanians. And so she takes the topic of Truganini, which is a exquisitely dangerous topic right now because of the contested history. We're beyond the black armband view of history because people have basically, well, particularly family historians, have made a number of nasty discoveries in the family tree, and I count myself in this category, and about what precisely people were doing on the frontier. Yes, the Victorians were surprisingly honest about what they were up to. It was their descendants who got bothered about it and tried to censor it. So, okay, the woman who was allegedly the last Tasmanian, her life, it's problematic because she's observed by other people and she was illiterate, so you don't get much of her own testimony. You have the same problem with Buckley, with William Buckley, who also was also illiterate. But what this book brings out is that both Buckley and Truganini were liminal figures. They were actually able to operate in two very different cultures with success. And by success, I meant they weren't killed. They maybe came close to it. So what this book does is that it forces a complete reassessment of Truganini, because I think the first time I came across her was a replica of her bones in the Christchurch National History Museum. And I think my mother said to me, poor woman, all she wanted was to be buried in her own country, and there she is in a case with no clothes on. And which eventually she did receive the burial, but she's very much alive in memory. And the role that she played, because she had a close relationship with Robinson, who was the protector of Aborigines, and she largely survives it via his diaries, which chronicled her closely for a very short time. What this book does is that, yes, she's seen as a victim. And you get to the end of it and you think, my God, what a survivor. It's already been shortlisted at least once for a biography award. And it's kind of a culmination of what Pybus has been building to in her studies of history over this year. And one of the really interesting things about it is that there's an anecdote about Truganini, which once you've read it, it's an atrocity which she was apparently a victim of. And it's in the histories fairly consistently. And Pybus actually throws it out the window. I'm reading the book and thinking, this is missing. And then I look, then I go to the notes and I see, oh, that's what she's done. And Pybus says quite, I think, arguably, it's an interesting argument that she says it turns up very late in the piece and she thinks it's dubious. But once you remove this anecdote of atrocity, then suddenly you can't, Truganini becomes a much more, you can't view her as a victim anymore. And that's one of the many interesting things this book does. So I do heartily recommend it. And I was reviewed it for the Oz, and they were very happy I reviewed it. Now, I think we discussed Friends and Rivals by Brendan Isle on the podcast already. I think we might have discussed that when we were talking about
Zora Cross.
Yeah, Zora Cross. I think.
Yeah, that I think. Been. Well, I know that we mentioned the book. I haven't actually got around to reading it as yet, but it was one of those ones that's always sticking there in the background. So, thanks for the reminder about that one. I'll go back and have a look.
Yeah, well, she's an absolute professional, and this one is kind of like odds and ends. And I personally think that it's great that she can put together a book of, you know, afterthoughts on some of her subjects and some new people like Nettie Palmer, and link them together It's just four short interlinked essays, and the only criticism I have of it is that it leaves out a really interesting anecdote about Nettie Palmer and Arthur Upfield and what the pair of them thought of each other, which I would have included, but then I'm not Niall, so there we go. So actually, and one more final non-fiction, again a review, and this one I was asked to do for The Age. A true crime, although it's a lot more complicated by that, Kate Summerscale, who's well known for Mr. Witcher, which I disagreed with her conclusions, but she's gone on to be a really interesting true crime writer in that she's not judgmental, unlike some, and she's not voyeuristic, again, which is the big problem in this genre. She's also interested in aftermaths, what happens to people's lives after a terrible crime. Do they achieve closure? And Timorlis proves it with this book, The Haunting of Alma Fielding, A True Ghost Story. This is a poltergeist story, and not Victorian, but set in the 1930s. Alma Fielding was a London housewife who was afflicted with a poltergeist rather spectacularly. And so the Institute for Psychical Research sent Nándor Fodor, who was a Hungarian investigator, to look into the case. And a real battle of wits erupted between the two of them, because if on the net you look at photos of Alma Fielding, you can realise that, oh, she looks really smart, and she was. And this one is about how he's investigating the poltergeist and whether she's faking it. What is interesting in here is that it's paralleled to the rise of Hitler and the headlong rush towards World War II, where people suddenly are very interested in portents and the supernatural as a distraction from what's going on with them in the appalling mundane world. And so this is quite a fascinating book. And one of the things is that Sigmund Freud gets consulted at one point, and Fodor gave up psychic investigation and became quite a good psychiatrist in New York, had quite a career. And I just found this one of these interesting books about an odd aspect of history that's been forgotten. You know, Alma similarly survived with no permanent damage and had quite a happy life. And so, yeah, it was one which was a pleasure to review. And a little bit of fiction here, not very much. As you might know, we read in this household quite a few Golden Age crime stories. And one writer who I've come to relatively late is Marjorie Allingham, who I now regard as, talk about the queens of crime, I'd put her just behind Josephine Tay, who I think is the real queen of crime from the Golden Age. And Allingham was very prolific, but very stylish, very acute. No Love Lost isn't a terribly well-known book, but it's two novellas. And one of them is about a young female doctor who's called out to treat a woman who, it turns out, was once a rival in love. The second one is Safer Than Love, which is about a young woman who's made a most ill-advised, hasty marriage to a school teacher, a headmaster in the country, and he's suddenly vanished. What you get is the crime and romance, but it's very, very deftly woven together. And you could tell, as this is my title of for occasional series on Facebook, she really knows what she's doing. And so I recommend check out Allingham, because long series, the Albert Campion detectives, but there's a lot of other interesting stuff. I suppose she's best well known for The Devil in the Fog, which is one of these books which crosses the border from Golden Age to the more gritty styles of the 1960s. One final book, and this was a gift from Jason Steger, the editor for The Age. I said, could I review it? And he said, well, we've got an interview, but have the book anyway. Now, Piranesi is Susanna Clarke, best known for Mr. Noel. Again, a book I'm not so keen on. I liked her early short stories, but when she came to write Mr. Noel, she just annoyed me by completely disappearing female agency. She might remember them. I think the most prominent woman is dead. She's the zombie for most of the book. Hardly an interesting character. But Pyramid Lady is interesting because once an author's had a success, they're normally pigeonholed and they have to repeat it. I think because Clark has been sick, she's had a chronic disease, and certainly when I met her, she was one of the palest persons I've ever met. And speaking as someone who's pale-skinned, she was worse than me. But this is something completely, this is something, she's leapt off into the unknown, and she came up with something which is obviously shorter because she wasn't able to manage a fantasy brick. But Piranesi is, well, she's moving through genres because you can say that Clark, that Mr. Noel was a gothic novel, but Piranesi is more modernist, and it's also a crime novel. And so it begins with this character who's living in this, hence he's living in this world where he's in this enormous ruined building full of statuary, which indeed looks, hence the title, as in the engraving of Piranesi. And as you go on with the book, you realise that he's amnesiac and that he's been imprisoned and that he's actually surviving within the context. And then the question is, who put him there? What's he doing there? What's the story behind this, which is gradually revealed? So it's a mystery, but it's also a portal. Yeah, I mean, she really knows her genres of fantasy. So this is a portal fantasy. You go through a door, and she has mentioned The Magician's Nephew by C.S. Lewis as being having input into this book. And it's a book that you had to actually had to sit down and then read, and then you read it again to see what she's doing. And sometimes that is deeply disappointing, but it wasn't in this case. People on various social media were citing the ending of the last Hilary Mantel as a superb example of novelistic closure in which you bring everything gradually. But actually, another really good example is what Clark does in this book, in that you have, it's sort of like a sort of musical, like a coda to a symphony. So you took a Tchaikovsky cello sonata or a violin sonata, and this is the last movement which brings all the themes together. And it's hard to do, and she makes it look effortless. So that's another one I think that a lot of people who would, if you said portal fantasy to them, they'd sort of run screaming down the garden and hide in the rabbit hutch.
There's been quite a lot of them recently.
Yeah, I think it's maybe a desire for escapism, but it's extremely well done. And
there's all the Sinan Maguire novellas about the wayward children, and also the 10,000 Doors of January from last year. I just think portal fantasies are one of those things that sort of go out of fashion a little bit and then come back in again. But she just uses that as just a means of getting into the book, and then it moves on from there, which I think is excellent.
Yeah, and it's a tool that she uses. And what is interesting is about somebody surviving in this very weird environment and how he interprets people. And then she manages to drag in quite a lot, like the creepier residues of the 1960s and all the cults that were happening. Oh, and also she gives more space to female agency, so that's
Well, I thought it was excellent. In fact, I spoke to David about this on the podcast late last year, and the one thing that struck me when I was about halfway through the book was I didn't know whether the main character was male or female. And, in fact, I was sitting there and it suddenly struck me and was saying, why am I thinking this character's of one sex or the other? Because I'd have to go back and reread it again, but I don't think there's anything in there that tells you whether they are male or female. It's just they're just
then, the male, until they're just named.
That's right, until somebody actually meets them. So that's quite interesting. And I think that's now whether those things that happen like that are deliberate or not, doesn't really matter, because if they occur, well, then it just adds to the interest of the reader in the book. So, yeah, look, I think Piranesi is going to be one of those books that's going to crop up on a lot of awards lists in the genre this year. Yeah, and I would not be at all surprised if it's on the Hugo list. I'm pretty certain it'll be on the
World Fantasy
and maybe well on the Nebula Award list as well. But we'll just have to see, because they'll be coming up shortly and it'll be interesting to see what happens.
You could also do an M. John and Harrison and, you know, conquer in the mainstream.
Yeah, you could do that.
That could be interesting.
Yeah, he could be there, and Stan Robinson, of course, might be there as well. But I think Clark is probably – people have been waiting for it for a long period of time, and when it came out, it didn't disappoint. It was not – as you said, it was not what they were expecting at all, and because of that, I think it's got an extra boost, because people are going, oh, well, firstly, it's shorter, for one thing. It's not a brick. It is shorter, and also it's different. So give it a try. And everybody go, oh, okay, this is very, very interesting. So there's a lot of intelligence behind that book. There's a lot going on in it. And as David said, and as you said, you have to pretty much read it twice to be able to work out what's going on. In fact, three or four times. David's now talking about going back and reading it for the third or fourth time in about 6 months, because he's still getting more out of it. So that's good. So is that it, Lucy? Is that the list?
Yeah, that's all. I mean, it wasn't. I've got a review book on my table at the moment, and you know, I've not very far in. I've already come up with several strong contenders for this year. So yeah, so far it's been a good reading year.
All right, good. Okay, well, thanks, Lucy. That's great. That was a good chat. Happy to do that. We've got one more at least coming up, and possibly two more best ofs over the next couple of weeks. But we've hit our time, I think, David. We don't want to bore the listener too much, but hopefully there's enough here of different styles for the listener to go out and find something. There's a lot of books out there, as there always is. And we try to move around a bit within the subgenres of SF and fantasy, and also spread our wings just a little, as we occasionally do.
Indeed. Yeah, indeed. All right.
Thanks, David. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks.
In a couple of weeks, indeed.
See you then.
Bye.